You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Lucrezia Reichlin really is a wonderful example of globalization. She was born in Italy, educated in NYU, has worked in Frankfurt for the ECB, taught in Brussels, and she's now professor of economics at the London Business School, a columnist for Italy's Il Corriere della Sera, a director of Unicredito and an Aegis insurance group, and she's involved in pretty much every European think tank I ever heard of. And on the side, she has started a company called Nowcasting, a firm that specializes in real-time economic data and near-term forecasting. But that's not the interesting part. I first heard of Lucrezia because I'm embarrassed to say this, when I read a wonderful profile of her in the IMF magazine, which is a lot more interesting than you think. And I want to tell you a little bit about her non-economic background. Her Swiss great-great-grandparents moved to southern Italy from Switzerland in the 19th century. Her mother's family is of Jewish origin and comes from Trieste, which used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Her mother, Luciana Castellina, was a prominent Italian communist intellectual, founder of the newspaper Il Manifesto, and later a member of the European Parliament. But she was expelled from the Italian Communist Party because of her criticism of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Lucrezia's father, Alfredo Reichlin, was in the Italian resistance during the war, joined the Communist Party in 1946, becoming one of its leaders and its shadow economy minister. Several years ago, her mother published a book, a memoir of her youth. It's based on her diary from 1943 to 1947. And Lucrezia wrote an introduction, and I want to read an excerpt from that. She writes, "We are the children of the baby boom, of the opulent society, of mass education, of the legalization of divorce and abortion, of new opportunities available to women, but we have also experienced disappointment." She left Rome in the early 70s for northern Italy, left Italy in 1978 for the United States, and unlike her parents, she says she took refuge in numbers rather than ideology. Quote, "I studied economics and econometrics because I wanted to have a more specialized technical tool to discuss progress. It was probably a bit of reaction to my parents, but also in Italy at the time, we studied a lot of Marx and the new Cambridge School, and I got a bit fed up with that, so I decided to move to the United States and got interested in econometrics." Lucrezia is going to talk for about half an hour. She has some slides, which will be on our website, and we'll post the audio on our website, and then we'll have time for some questions afterwards. I can't think of a more timely moment. We now know that the source of all financial instability turns out to be the Swiss National Bank. Who knows what surprises this afternoon will bring. Lucrezia.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I mean, I didn't expect you to reveal the family secret, especially in the U.S., you know. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Eurozone. So, as David said, it's Switzerland, the source of turbulence these days, but, you know, maybe it's related. So let me just give you a little bit of data about the recent past, which, you know, will lead us easily on monetary policy and the choices faced by the ECB at this juncture. I think what has been happening since 2011 is quite amazing if you look at the historical perspective. This is real GDP growth year on year, the U.S., the red line, and the euro area, the blue line. So you see that at least since, actually here I'm starting in the 80s, but at least since the 70s, recessions and recoveries have been very synchronized. The shaded areas are the MBR recessions and the recessions in Europe as dated by the CEPR, which is a similar organization. Oh, since 2011, we had something that had never happened before, so that the euro area went back into recession, and while the U.S., although, you know, we may be disappointed about the economic performance of the U.S., you know, it's still clearly in positive territory. So this is it's a recession which has to be explained with the differences in policies and is quite a unique episode. If you look at recent data, this is an index that I construct, which takes in consideration a bunch of different data in the economy. We can see that not only we had a recession in 2011, but also since 2014, it looks like we had a new slowdown, just the moment in which the U.S. Enter a much more convincing recovery. And this actually, the second slowdown, if you look at the numbers, it affects not only the periphery of Europe, but also Germany, the core of Europe. Now, if you look at the nominal side of the economy, is also a quite a dismal picture. Here is nominal GDP, year-on-year growth rate, HICP inflation, which is what the ECB is targeting, consumption, and monetary M3, which is broad monetary aggregates, which is something also that a variable that also the ECB pays some attention to. So you see they're quite flat. In fact, inflation, the last reading of inflation is negative, so we have been heading towards deflation since 2011. So there are three explanations of why, you know, the second recession, which hit only Europe, why this new slowdown. One is monetary policy. The ECB has been late in recognizing the threat of deflation. The other one is fiscal policy. Fiscal policy have been pro-cyclical in the euro area. And the reason is that, you know, the treaty that bounds the European countries together, you know, gives, you know, establishes some rules on debt and on deficit. And so pro-cyclical fiscal policy is motivated by the need of fiscal consolidation. So to, you know, to take care of the debt, which was partly the legacy of the crisis. There is no doubt that fiscal policy has weighed on demand and in a way has been self-defeating because if you look at the debt to GDP ratios in most countries, you can see that it has been increasing and is definitely not stabilized. And then the third issue is debt overhang. I mean, of course, this is related to point two, but we came out of the 2008 crisis with a huge amount of debt, public and private sector. And this, of course, continues to weigh on the economy because it induces deleveraging either in the private or public sector. I will argue, that will be my point of the slides today, that you cannot understand monetary policy without understanding this broader context. These three things are related. So let me talk about monetary policy briefly. I claim that the ECB has been late in recognizing the threat of deflation. We are actually now at what is called the zero lower bound. Actually, differently with the U.S., the zero lower bound, depending on how you measure it, but hit the euro area much later than in the U.S. So this is really something that has to do with the second recession, not with the first. And then, you know, this liquidity operation that the ECB has implemented to provide banks with liquidity, you know, at long term and at a fixed rate, the long term refinancing operation, they have not really worked that well in these more recent times. Now, let me just briefly show you some charts. This funny chart here is the headline HICP harmonized consumption index inflation, and the dotted lines are the forecasts of the ECB at each, you know, different date. You can see that since 2011, the ECB staff forecast has been too optimistic with respect to inflation. So they, in order to understand, you know, the policy problem that the ECB is facing now is that not only inflation has been declining, but actually it has been surprisingly, it has been, you know, there have been a consistent surprise on the decline of inflation. And in the forecast of the ECB have been biased in one direction. Now, for what concerns the lower bound, I mean, this are some calculations that you may possibly do. I mean, you can try to see what would the interest rate would be, the short-term interest rate on the left-hand side, if the ECB had behaved according to past regularities. That would be the black line, and the red line is what actually where the short-term interest rate has been. You can see that there is a significant difference. So this is what I call the zero lower bound. Not only that the interest rate is close to zero, but it should be elsewhere. And somehow, you know, it does not. And this is on the right-hand side, you have the long-term interest rate. And then finally, this is the balance sheet of the euro system. You can see that after a peak that was reached in 2012, in this context which I've described, the balance sheet has been shrinking rather than increasing. So this is this is the asset side of the balance sheet. And, you know, in a way, because of the type of liquidity policy that ECB has been implemented, the size of the balance sheet depends on when the banks give back the loans that have been obtained by in these operations. And so, you know, they've been facing this endogenous decline in the size of the balance sheet. Fiscal policy, I mean, there are different ways in which you can look at the procyclicality of fiscal policy and how restrictive it has been. This is one way, for sure imperfect, but just give you the idea. So this is an index comparing three recessions, the 1980 recession, the 1991 recession, and the recent recession. It's an index on government debt to GDP on the left, government deficit over GDP on the right. I'm putting equal to 100 the initial, the beginning of the recession. Oh, let's focus on the right-hand panel here. You see that, you know, the 2008 crisis induced a large increase in the government deficit to GDP ratio. You know, that's due to the denominator, the fall in output. But then since the third quarter 2009, when the euro area entered a very feeble recovery, you know, there has been consolidation, so that a dramatic decline of that ratio due to most countries running primary surpluses, in particular the countries of the periphery. So, and I think it's this, the shape of this of the green line with respect to the blue and the red line, which is, you know, the historical behavior of the deficit to GDP ratio in recessions, that gives you an idea of the size of the negative fiscal shock, or the positive fiscal shock, I don't know how you know, but of the kind of procyclicality of fiscal policy. Now, on that, I want to say basically two things. That on the left you have private debt of the financial sector, so just the financial sector over GDP, and on the right you have public debt. You can see the euro area, the red line, in comparison with other big countries, Japan, the UK, US, and the developed markets in general, the black line. So the point of the left panel is to say that actually, although the level of debt in the financial sector in Europe was smaller than the UK for sure and the US, the US even not that much, there has not been stabilization since the crisis. So the adjustment in the financial sector was delayed in Europe, and it was delayed to 2013. So we are now seeing something in the recent data, but we did not see the early deleverage that we have seen in the US. Okay, so this is also part of the story of why economic performance has been so disappointed post-crisis. You know, now we are starting deleveraging, but more has to come, okay, so that we are not at the end of this deleveraging cycle like in the US, okay? So this is something that still will wait on the economy. On the right-hand side, you see the public debt, and you can see that, you know, the trajectory is not very encouraging. Public debt to GDP ratio as a whole is still going up, so it's not stabilized. Is not particularly impressive if you look at the level and compare, you know, to, in general, to the developed markets, you know, the euro area is below. This is thanks to Japan especially. However, you know, it's mainly, there is a redistribution problem. Okay. Some of the, you know, Germany does not, has a debt over the GDP ratio, which is around 60%. But you have a country like Italy, which are 135, and France is getting very close to 100, and also Spain, which started from a low debt to GDP ratio, is actually getting up in that, in the, you know, is definitely increasing the ratio. Now, you have in your slides, the composition and the level for different countries, so I'm not going to discuss that, but I mean, I think it's quite an interesting reading because you can see, also that, you can see how, in what sense is there a distribution problem between countries, with some countries having a higher GDP, debt to GDP ratios than others, in particularly, these are the debt countries, but let me see. Okay, so you have the core. I missed the crucial slides, which is that shows it. I mean, the countries at risk, the big countries at risk, which are Italy, Spain, and France. Now, okay, so the three issues have to be analyzed jointly. Delay ECB action is explained, so why the ECB did not act before in terms of, using tools that other central banks have used, like sovereign QE. Well, partly is because they were concerned about moral hazard in a situation in which some of the sovereign may be considered insolvent or maybe, could become insolvent as some in some scenarios for GDP or interest rate. Procyclical fiscal policy was also motivated by the same concern, moral hazard concern, in the context of a monetary union without a common fiscal backing. And the debt overhang is a weight on the economy because it induces deleveraging, which, and therefore, monetary policy and fiscal policy, which have procyclical effect. So what is next? Okay, so I expect very little action on the fiscal front and on the debt overhang front. Although I don't exclude that some changes, that a change in the treaty will be discussed in the future. There are increasingly, there are increasing concern about how the treaty has not been working. I think in the immediate future we should not expect much on the fiscal front. However, I mean, as it has been discussed extensively in the press, we should expect some action from the ECB. Next week, there is an important policy meeting, and the market expects that the ECB, for the first time, will start purchases of sovereign bonds, so sovereign QE. So let me now spend the next 10 minutes discussing about how we should understand QE in the context of the euro area. I mean, I want to emphasize, because we are in the US, that this is going to be a unique experiment. So sovereign purchases in an economy which has a federal institution regulating monetary policy, but no common fiscal backing. So the type of concerns and the policy discussion should be really, I think, different because of different institutional setups. So what is the general issue? So I think this is a unique experiment. There is a very complex relation between fiscal and monetary aspect, which have to do on concerns on how the distribution of risk and the sort of how risk sharing will work in the union, given the fact that the budgetary responsibility is decentralized. Concerns are particularly strong from the creditor country side because of the leverage situation that I described. Okay, so you cannot really understand the current discussion without, understanding the overall situation in terms of debt overhang. Now, the concern, which is partly justified, I think, is that the ECB, if the ECB ends up buying a large proportion of government debt and assuming, sovereign credit risk in its balance sheet, there will be no threat anymore of debt restructuring, okay? So that, the debt will be held by the official sector. And because of the lack of debt of threat restructuring, this will eliminate market discipline. And in fact, in a monetary union, you want that possibility of restructuring to be there, okay? So to create some market discipline. And, De facto, if this program is going to be large and open-ended and so on, that would effectively mean that ECB is insuring the private sector from the sovereign risk. And this, in fact, is what the market wants the ECB to do and what the market sort of expect. Now, the thing that I want to flag is that the treaty that that we have in Europe has a paradox. So in principle, and the ECB has to face this paradox. So the rationale for QE is a purely monetary policy one, okay? The ECB is undershooting the target. The target is 2% or just below 2%. And of course, now the other tools that they've been using, they have not been working, so they have to move on purely monetary policy ground and do what other central banks have done. But, okay, the paradox is there. So on one hand, the treaty has created rules to limit the redistributional effect of monetary policy amongst different countries. It has imposed all kinds of legal restriction prohibiting monetary financing. It has a no bailout clause that exactly, you know, is there in order to prevent this cross-country resharing of fiscal risk. But on the other hand, when there is pressure on the debt front, the ECB is calling to action, as we have seen in 2012, and is calling to action to defend the common currency and to the survival of the euro. And basically this has been done by preventing exit or preventing default, as we have seen in the case of Greece. Therefore, knowing that the ECB will ultimately defend the euro, the market expect that, you know, the ECB will provide an implicit guarantee on all debt. Therefore, from the discussion within the ECB, as I understand it, you know, is to implement a program which should not be a pure monetary policy financing operation, should reinsure the market, but at the same time, you should be such that it is not going to kill all market incentives, should not be perceived as a blank guarantee on public debt. So what is the current policy discussion then? They could go for a large program, maybe, you know, around 1 trillion. These are the numbers that have been floating around. There is a question of what to buy, okay, either a single security, triple A's, but this will be very divisive, or a bundle, a security composed of different, weighted in some way, so they can go for market capitalization, that would be a very bold action, buying a lot of Italian debt in that case, or they most likely go acquisition of securities which are average by GDP, which is the capital key of the ECB. So, and this, you know, will be sort of a very, if they go in that way, either market cap or GDP weighting, it will be a very bold action, which will raise concerns of credit risk, as I pointed out. But in order to face those concerns, they could, you know, centralize the decision on the purchases, but then decentralize the credit risk. So decentralize the credit risk in the balance sheet of the national central banks. Or otherwise, they can go for a smaller program or just buy triple A's or just buy, less purchases, but keep the risk sharing within the euro system balance sheet as it is done now for the other monetary policy operation. So these are the trade-offs, size versus decentralization. You know, on one hand, the program must be large to convince the market, but the price that they may have to face in order not to be too divisive within the governing council is to say, okay, we will decentralize risk, okay? And many intermediate options, of course, are on the table, okay? You can think of all kind of possible different things. Now, if they say decentralize, which is now the current expectation from a lot of market participants, that they will actually go for a large program with decentralization of risk, there is a danger that the market will perceive this as you know, as sort of the first step towards further decentralization and segmentation of financial markets, which in turn will put some pressure on the periphery bonds. And, you know, especially if the economy doesn't pick up, that will, you know, sort of further go in the direction of geographical segmentation of financial markets, which has been one of the main story of the crisis. Since the crisis, we have seen that the flight to safety in the euro area associated with the crisis has taken the form of a home bias in different segments of the financial markets, but especially in the sovereign segment. We now we are in a situation in which, you know, if you look at, you know, government, this is government securities over total asset in the, in financial institutions, the domestic component has increasing since the crisis, while the non-domestic other euro area countries has been declining. So before the crisis, this was a very financially integrated market within the euro area, and since the crisis, it has been segmented. If you look at Italian banks as an example, you can see these are the big Italian bank, different institutions. You can see the net sovereign exposure on Core Tier 1, or the net, this is in December 2013, and this is September 2014. So the sovereign exposure to their own sovereign has increased. The same is true for Spanish banks, but also for core banks, okay? So the asset side of the balance sheet is becoming increasingly colored from the geographical point of view with a very strong home bias. So this has created a correlation of risk between the sovereign and the credit risk. It has been called the diabolic loop between sovereign and credit risk. Okay, the sovereign goes under, the banks goes under. If the bank goes under, the sovereign goes under. Is a huge problem, and is a problem that should not get worse in the case QE is done with a decentralization of credit risk. Okay, that's the danger, is that if they go that way, the diabolic loop will become worse rather than better. Okay, so but something has to be done, okay? And so what I want to argue here that you know, if QE would be designed optimally, it should actually address both the monetary policy concern, okay? So being forceful from the monetary policy, you know, to address the inflation issue, but should also at the same time address the second issue, which is financial market fragmentation, because otherwise it will be self-defeated. So there are two issues. One is fragmentation, so they would need to force the bank to diversify the geographical origin of the sovereign fixed income portfolio. And the second issue is that they should face the moral hazard of risk-sharing problem. And here I want to put on the table a proposal which will say, rather than decentralize, a proposal which is not at all in the cards, so it's purely, you know, okay, so that maybe would be useful for future discussion, that rather than decentralize, which is the way in which they will have to face the credit risk, they could create a safe asset from the senior tranche of composite security. So this is a proposal that I put together with my colleague at LSE, Luis Gallicano, and has a monetary policy aspect and says that QE should go for diversified securities, okay? We should not just buy AAAs, okay, but we should buy, you know, all the bonds weighted by GDP, the capital key. You could tranche this composite security and have a senior tranche and a junior tranche in fixed proportion. So this will be sort of a synthetic safe bond for the euro area. The ECB will announce it, and I think there will be the creation of a safe bond from the market. And this should be complemented to some regulatory changes or to some announcements. So the ECB will, or the single supervisory mechanism, would announce that only the senior tranche of the security would be counted as risk-free for the purposes of risk weighting and liquidity coverage ratio calculations. Okay, which would be imply a change in the current treatment of sovereign bonds. You know, as it is now, Italian bonds have the same treatment as the German bonds. So this is kind of trying to be in between these two extremes, okay, full guarantee and, you know, just buy AAA or, you know, buy composite but decentralized risk. Now, the advantages would be the creation of the of a large safe asset, which would be like the natural thing for the central bank to buy. So tranching should be seen as an alternative to decentralization. And then there will be an incentive for banks to hold a diversified portfolio, so in a way to break this loop, this correlation of risk between sovereign and bank risk. So I think it's an interesting proposal. It's a proposal that I've discussed with ECB people and that, you know, maybe become relevant at some point down the road. Not immediately, of course, because it also requires some regulatory and legal changes. Okay, so going back of what is on the so if you put also the tranching, you can see that, you know, there is a decision matrix that the ECB will have. If they go for buying a composite security, they can just buy a security formed by each country debt in fixed proportion, or they can go for our proposal. Or otherwise, they can buy individual security without tranching or individual security with tranching, and you can think of all, you know, combination of these things. I mean, I don't want to bore you with too many details, but I mean, this I think is at least useful to get the idea of how complex the decision process is, because unlike in the Fed, it's not at all obvious what the ECB should buy and in what proportions. And what they will end up doing will have an effect on the fiscal implication of monetary policy action, which is at the core of the current discussion in Europe. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to go for the pros and the cons of all different proposals, but, I mean, I just wanted to give you the flavor of, you know, what is the current discussion. Now, what are the scenarios? I think, as I said, I don't think our proposal will be considered, at least not in the short run. The preliminary ruling of the European Court that that suggests that sovereign purposes are legal, they are not in violation with the treaty, has been a very, although expected, okay, I think it should be, a good thing for Mario Draghi, let's say. And so I expect that ECB will go for for buying not only AAA, but, purchases of diversified portfolio. Or I expect, however, most likely that, if they want to be big, they will go for standard decentralization risk. So I think that this issue has to be seen with some attention. However, this is not going to be the end of the story, because I don't expect that the deflationary threat is going to be end anytime soon. And I think that without other policy tools, more decisive fiscal action and maybe some overall agreement on how to deal with the debt overhang, the legacy debt out of the crisis, the euro area will be in stagnation for the future. Again, I mean, I don't expect, a convincing recovery anytime soon. So the ECB will be there with these purchases for a while. And I think some of the issues that I flag will, continue to be relevant. How, the central bank will act will have also an effect on the whole political economy of the euro area and, the relation between creditors and debtor countries. And with that, I finish. Thank you very much. I hope I didn't speak too much.
Well, thank you. I find that the best thing about having conversations about Europe is that no matter how gloomy you get about Washington, Europe always looks worse. So I appreciate that. We could use a little of that here. I hope we can return the favor someday. Let me just ask a couple of questions before we turn to the audience. So I'm going to be clear on what the markets expect of the ECB and what you expect of the ECB. I think you suggested the markets might be expecting a bigger program.
Well, I mean, I think what I expect for whatever it's worth, okay, is a big program. It is something maybe larger than 500 billions. I expect something relatively open-handed. I would expect a communication that would clarify that the size of the balance sheet is not a final target, but is an operational target. And so that whatever size or pace of purchases they decide, they will decide at the end, you know, is linked to some, you know, forecast of, mm-hmm. of the evolution of inflation. Oh, but that they will remain ready to adjust the purchases in relation to the new data. Okay, so I think this is what I expect. What the market expect, especially since the court ruling, I've seen that the market has, you know, they were expecting, I think they're also expecting something large of this, you know, of the order between, you know, maybe higher than 500 billions. I think on the risk-sharing issues, I've seen different opinions around. I still think they will go for decentralization, but maybe they will be bolder. I don't know. I mean, for sure, the Germans will oppose anyway, so they will have Weidmann voting against. It is not clear what other countries like Finland and so on will do. But, you know, I don't know whether it is politically conceivable that monetary policy in the euro area is systematically run again, with a negative German vote. So in that respect, I think that the decentralization of risk maybe will be the price to pay.
And decentralization of risk means that if Italy can't pay its debts, that somehow that's on the Italian central bank.
The Italian central bank and eventually on the Italian taxpayers.
All right, so...
Which is a bit cosmetic, right?
Yeah, I think so. All right, now, how is this supposed to work to make the economy better? Is long-term rates are already very low. Europe has a very bank-centric system. It seems to have already... The expectation of QE seems to have already led to a depreciation of the euro. Is there more to this, or is it just kind of a psychological thing that the ECB... says, we will do whatever it takes.
You sound like Weidmann, you know? Weidmann says...
Please!
Weidmann says, you know, this will serve no purpose. And in fact, the Financial Times, you probably have seen, you know, they have asked several market participants, the majority says that the quantitative easing in the euro area will be ineffective. Now, this is possibly the case. In fact, if I talk to banks, they also tell me that they will adjust their liability size, but for sure they're not going to start lending, as the Fed or QE, because there are lots of other, there are concerns about capital and the non-performing loans and so on. However, you have to think about what would happen if they didn't do it. And in a way, just the announcement has already had put some downward pressure on exchange rate and long-term interest rate. In that respect, I mean, they are prisoner of their own communication. They have already, you know, announced it in a way, so they will have to go for it. But it is danger. I hope that other tools will be put on the... will be used to confront the stagnation, because this over responsibility on the ECB shoulders is extremely dangerous. Okay.
Right, but surely if you have a central bank with an inflation target that it's missing, the central bank missing a lot, the central bank has some obligation to do everything it can think of.
Exactly.
Right. But you made an interesting point in your presentation, which is, and let me make sure I get this right. You think the fundamental problem that Europe faces is a debt overhang, that banks won't lend, the economy can't grow because there's so much of an overhang of debt and people expect higher taxes in the future or something, right? And you're suggesting that one of the downsides of QE is that it is seen as the ECB basically guaranteeing the sovereign and takes the pressure off for restructuring.
Well, okay, so it's very, so on one hand, when you have that overhang, you want to use fiscal policy, okay, but the fiscal policy, we can't use it because of the treaty. So you can say, given the institutional constraints, this actually supports very strong QE. In fact, what has been called helicopter money, right? I mean, it can be thought as a sort of a substitute for a fiscal transfers, which in that conditions, if you forget about moral hazard, about this, political issues between creditors and debtors and so on, maybe it would be the right thing to do. I mean, even more bolder than what has been even discussed. Okay. So permanent purchases. On the other hand, because we have all these different fiscal jurisdictions, there is a tendency in the euro area for countries, there is a tendency to kill all market disciplines, okay? Because once a market expects this kind of action from the point of view of the ECB, it doesn't put any pressure on interest rate. So now Italian interest rate, well, not exactly, okay? But, before the crisis, the Greek interest rates on the sovereign debts were the same as the German interest rate on the debt. That was clearly mispriced from the market. Then there was this huge divergence during the debt crisis, and now we are back in a risk-off situation in the expectation of the ECB. So I think this is too much, okay? So it's an overkilling. So we want to have a monetary policy tool, but we do not want to kill market incentives, okay? But it's a fine line, okay? So ideally, we want to have some coordination between monetary and fiscal policy and, to have a more diversified package of demand management. But given the constraints, a lot is on the shoulder of the ECB, so they will have to be cautious, okay? And I don't think that the union will survive if the ECB becomes the guarantor of all the debt countries.
So
politically will not survive.
So so what does this all look like 5 years from now?
The optimistic scenario, renegotiation of the treaty, I think the ECB will be there with, doing purchases and then there will be a renegotiation of the treaty, which would allow for more active fiscal policy. Maybe there will be some debt redemption, some kind of debt agreement. This was something that was discussed in 2012. Also, there was a proposal by the Council of the German Council of Economic Advisors to have debt redemption for that part of the debt which is considered legacy debt, in exchange for different rules for the steady state, rules that would consider, the possibility of restructuring within the euro area. I think that's the right way to go. This proposal has been killed, so it's been, now everybody thinks that, QE will be a substitute for that. I think, in my view, it would be much better to have some debt restructuring, some fiscal policy, and some QE. And I hope that we will be gradually moving in that direction, okay? I mean, there is some of us who are pushing for that direction. Of course, we are not very popular. I mean, the German economists, central bankers, and so on, now they have very different views. But we'll see. If the stagnation continues.
That's the optimistic scenario. What's the pessimistic one?
Well, the pessimistic one is that there will be continuous stagnation. There are two pessimistic scenarios. One is stagnation but stability. More fiscal consolidation, adjustment through real wages and, high youth unemployment, and somehow, this will not create too much political troubles because the Europeans are very patient. And the third scenario, which is the real pessimistic one, is that there be a political crisis with anti-euro parties winning elections in countries like France, Spain. These are the risk, beside Greece, okay, which requires a separate discussion, but maybe down the line also Italy. And also the risk-off scenario, you know, okay, with the ECB doing QE, okay, some pressure on the peripheral bonds will be out, but if the discussion within the governing council becomes too complex, I think the market may also start pricing in, credit event. And then here I think that Italy is the dangerous country.
I know that Don Cohn has to leave, so I want to ask you one more question or two, but let me give Don a chance before he goes. Don, there's a mic there.
Thank you. Don Cohn, Brookings. It sounded like you were very much arguing that without some debt relief and debt mutualization, nothing's going to work very well here. So I have really two questions. One is, doesn't your proposal not have real debt mutualization and debt relief, since you're trying to break off the safe tranches and leave all the rest of the risk in the market? So I don't see how your proposal fits in with that, if the AAA tranches really are safe. That's a separate discussion, I guess. And the second thing would be, it also sounds as if where the ECB sounds like it's going, which is a QE of size, but leaving the risk distributed, isn't really going to do very much, because it won't break the diabolical loop. Is there anything the ECB could do that doesn't involve debt mutualization that might be helpful from a monetary policy perspective?
Well, I mean, from the second question, I would say that my proposal is better than the centralization, okay? So that the tranching is better than centralization. But I think that if we had debt redemption, that would even be better. I said that I don't think that debt redemption is in the cards right now. Although things may change. For example, Olli Rehn, who, you know, is a conservative, vice president of the European Parliament and former commissioner, at a recent meeting of the European Parliament, he said, yeah, maybe we should go for debt redemption. So, but of course, this is very difficult, okay? First of all, you should not announce it if you go for that, and also it has to really be something that put all the parties together, right? Because otherwise, I think Greece, now we have to see how they will solve the Greece situation, because, how much debt redemption will be in the Greek situation, because that could be actually, would it already, give some elements to understand how the problem will be dealt with for other countries. Of course, now everybody says Greece is different, but after all, Greece is not that different, okay? So that, if they create a precedent, that's...
But Don thinks your proposal also eliminates the pressure for debt restructuring, right?
Well, no. I mean, there is the junior tranche will be, all this, the sovereign
market discipline
there.
Yeah. So, what's your forecast?
The question for my proposal is whether there will be enough demand for the liquid for the junior tranche, given the threat of restructuring.
I see. And so, Greece, what's happening there? What's your scenario?
Okay, there I'm positive. I hope that I will not be proved to be wrong. I think that that Tsipras has very crazy people in his own party, but I think he's not crazy. Actually, he's some of the things he says are quite reasonable in my view. I mean, given my communist past, I'm now. I can be suspected. But anyway, it is likely that he will, if he wins, that he will govern with a coalition. And therefore he will have to come to a compromise. So there the uncertainty, the issue will be the uncertainty of the process, okay, that, could create destabilizing issues. But I expect there will be a coalition with centrists, and I expect that there will be some negotiation and that some of the debt will be rescheduled. Although I also expect that the European authorities will be tough on the conditions of the first program, because otherwise they will lose completely credibility. Mm-hmm. So it will be complicated, but You know, I don't expect Greece to exit. I don't think that anybody wants Greece to exit. I think there have been there has been some noise in the press with the Spiegel leaked some point of view from the Germans saying we don't care about Greece, they can go. Now, you know, we can't prevent contagion because we are in a different situation than in 2012. But then immediately after, actually, Merkel, you know, corrected the message, and you know, several other people have. So finally,
what would cause the Germans to change their mind about debt restructuring, about you know, fiscal transfers, about whatever? I mean, it seems to me the German economy does okay.
Not great,
but Merkel seems very popular, despite what seems to be a less than courageous leadership. It seems to me that the only thing the German businessmen I talk to say, well, we're just investing elsewhere, so, you know, we're voting with our money. It's the only thing it strikes me is that it must be a little scary to be in Germany, to have been committed to the euro, and think that if you don't like Hollande, you might get Le Pen, and you might get a reaction in Spain, and suddenly you have a much different political climate in Europe, and the terror in Paris can't make him feel any more comfortable. But I'm looking at this from Washington. Is that something that the Germans worry about, or do they think they're immune to that?
Well, the Germans are worried. Now, they have an anti-Euro political party, which is growing of their own. And I think that this is also explain why Merkel, you know, is trying to, you know, be in between. You know, I think that it's very difficult. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that the Germans have to be understood in the sense that some of the things they're saying, I mean, if you look at the amount of corruption in Italy, in Greece, and if you think, for example, in the Italian case, my country, you know, it's a rich country, a country which is rich in asset, but has not been growing for a long time, in which, you know, there is a huge amount of tax evasion and so on. To ask the Germans to take care of our debt is quite embarrassing. And So there is mutual suspicions, and which is justified from both parts. So I don't have an answer for you. I think that so far, the majority of the European citizens want to stay in the euro, but this is changing very fast. Mm. And I think that the French episode is a wake-up call, which is linked to the issue of youth unemployment, which is becoming, I think in the U.S., 50% of youth unemployment, which are the figures that we have in some of these countries, will be intolerable politically, okay? And so it's quite surprising that we haven't seen a revolution in Europe. But, you know, things may deteriorate further down the line unless something is done. Now, for example, Juncker has now designed an investment package, okay, so that, you know, increasingly people are talking about pro-growth policies, you know, beyond monetary policy. So far, you know, it's very underwhelming, but maybe more will be done.
It strikes me it's always just enough to get us to the next summit without a revolution.
That's right.
Right. I'm sure there's some questions. Gentleman here in the front. And tell us who you are so we can...
Chris Bledowski from Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. Fiscal policy is not possible because of the treaty. That's what you said. 2 weeks ago at the American Economic Association, Martin Feldstein from Harvard made the following proposal. Why not make a revenue-neutral fiscal adjustment, milking out different elasticities of supply with respect to different tax types, and possibly he may have thought also of multipliers on the expenditure side, but I think he meant the tax side, that would not infringe upon the treaty, but nonetheless would give us a net gain on the output side. He said, do not centralize any of this. When I probed him about this, he said, keep it totally decentralized. Even if one or two countries goes ahead with it and gives an example and it works, it could spill into the rest of the Eurozone. Is this something that you think some countries might consider. For example, Italy, I think, would be a prime candidate, and some of the others. Is this either discussed or you think it makes sense?
Well, actually, funny enough, he just sent it to me, okay, because, you know, he's very keen to, you know, for people to write about it and so on. So I haven't really looked at the details. But I understand that he would imply an increase in corporate tax, which will be very unpopular, I think, in Italy for sure. But I mean, maybe there is some room to go around it. I haven't really looked at the proposals, but, you know, definitely something to consider. There would be maybe credibility issues on Ricardian equivalence type of considerations. But, you know, maybe, the thing that struck to me is that he would imply an increase in corporate tax, which is not something that is going to be very popular right now. But,
Brian?
You know, I'm not...
Ralph Bryant here at Brookings. It would be very interesting to hear you say a little bit more in detail about the ECB QE with the decentralization of credit risk. If, just to take Italy as an example, if the ECB buys large amounts of...
Hold the mic closer.
Large amounts of Italian bonds, what would happen in detail to make the government in Italy take that credit? Would there be new entries on the balance sheets of the Banca d'Italia and the ECB, or would some kind of a written statement be made? Are there legal constraints either in Italy? Exactly how would this decentralization of risk occur?
Well, I think that the National Central Bank will have to provision for this credit risk. So the question is, how much reserves do they have? And I think that so far so good. I mean, I think that there is buffer, okay, in the national central banks to be used for that purpose. The question, if there is a credit event, I mean, if Italy go bust, okay, what will happen? That at that point, you know, the Banca d'Italia will have to be recapitalized by its own treasury. Those taxes will have to be raised. And then the question is whether this is going to be feasible or not. And maybe at the end, the ECB will have to act as lender of last resort anyway. So that is a very strange program, no? Because the Banca d'Italia cannot monetize because only the ECB can.
I liked your earlier description better. Cosmetic. Gentleman in the front here.
Yeah, I'm Norman Birnbaum from Georgetown. I noticed that everybody regrets the rigidity of the German situation, but the obvious solution to it is one people would regret even more, namely a left-left-green coalition. But I would like to ask our speaker if she would care to comment a bit on the extremely complex and to many Americans utterly untransparent domestic situation in Italy at the moment?
You know, not only untransparent for Americans, but also for Italians. The domestic situation in Italy, is actually better than it used to be. Now we have a relatively popular Presidente del Consiglio, who has, however, a divided party, so that I think that the opposition, in Italy, the opposition is very fragmented now. And so there is an expectation that the Democratic Party, which is the majority party, if there is going to be an election, they are going to win with a wide margin. However, the party itself is very divided, so far, Renzi controls it, but there is a kind of vocal minority. This slows down the process of reform. But so far, they have been able, for example, to pass the labor reform, which is quite a radical reform. The process is not totally over through Parliament, but if we'll come out of the Parliament similar to what has been proposed, that will change the labor market quite substantially. The question is whether this is going to be a game changer for the Italian economy. There I have some doubts, but in any way, politically it's important because it will show within the euro area framework that Italy actually can deliver reforms, okay, which is something that... Of course, if the situation of negative growth persists with persistent unemployment, I expect that the more radical party, anti-euro, will gain some strength. But paradoxically, they are weaker than in countries like Spain, where actually the economy is doing much better.
A lot turns on Italy, right? I mean, it's the big indebted country that isn't growing.
Yeah, Italy is the worst case because it is not growing. It has been shrinking. And it came into the crisis after 15 years of very low growth. So Spain, before the euro, before the 2008 crisis, in the first 10 years of the euro, had rate of growth which averaged 3.54%. Italy grew at 1%. So Italy is the sick man of Europe, a sick woman of Europe. And I don't think that this kind of stories can be changed through labor reform or through three cosmetic things. I mean, it's a deep and rooted issues. Very low productivity, small size of firms, okay, so under scale, so with even export has not done very well in Europe, in Italy, which traditionally is a export-led country, completely underdeveloped south with big issues of, kind of inefficient and corrupted public sector, and so on and so forth.
The back with the laptop.
Thank you. My name is Jeremiah Reamer. On this question, the north-south divide in Europe is often seen in terms of complying with or not complying with the rules of the various stability packets. But there's a kind of a governance dimension to this that I think is sometimes overlooked. And I'm wondering if, as an Italian living in London, you have some thoughts about this. What I'm referring to is the great suspicion in the northern countries that the South is mired in clientelism. Now, that's a big problem for Greece, where both of the major established parties are big patronage dispensing machines. Your own country, of course, has an experience of kind of going back and forth between clientelism and, shall we say, technocratic house cleaning. And the generation that tried to make the historic compromise when the Eurocommunists were around, that was to some extent, it's not appreciated today, a movement for what we in this country, since the progressive era, have called good government. In other words, there's a generation of Italians who are maybe leaving the political class now, it includes Prodi and Napolitano and so on, who are aware that you can mediate between, shall we say, good government and a welfare state that tries to have well-managed collective provision of social goods. I'm wondering if that generation has left any kind of legacy on the Renzi generation and is in a position to sort of mediate between the North and the South from the sort of governance perspective that I just outlined.
Well, I'm afraid that generation had left very little legacy because, they were very unsuccessful. They were very unsuccessful, and corruption has increased, if anything, in Italy. So we had the Mani Pulite episode in the 1990s where the Socialist Party was very much involved, not the Communists, the Socialist Party was very much involved in the corruption scandals. Then we had a big change with Berlusconi, and then now, there is a huge amount of scandals that are coming out again. You know, this goes in cycles, which involve everybody, the Democratic Party, the right, the left, everybody. So, citizens are very much cynical now about the political class. So we are kind of going through an Americanization of policies. I mean, political parties, they are not rooted anymore to anything, and that... Very few people vote. The unions are very weak. So, I mean, we are in a transition, okay? So it's not clear what we are anymore. So we are not what we were, but we are not the U.S. either, okay? So and in this empty space, Renzi is taking a lot of, you know, that's his space. But I would say he's more like a Latin American type of leader than a modern European leader. I mean, he's a little bit strong, maybe what I'm saying, but there is that danger.
What about the UK? What do you think? Do you think they'll vote to get out of the EU, or do you think this is just a lot of domestic politics?
Well, I mean, there is a risk. Of course, you know, that will depend on whether Labour will win the elections or not. But there is definitely a risk. This could be, you know, the next big accident. And, of course, the fact that the euro area crisis continues is not very inspiring for the anti-EU party in the UK. So, yeah, this is something to be watched. I mean, I think that... Of course, if Labour wins, nobody will be strong enough to govern on his own. But if Labour wins, the idea is that maybe they will govern with the Scottish Independent Party. So that will be a kind of UK crazy.
Randy?
Thank you, David. I'm Randy Henning at American University. I wanted to get back to kind of this question of the design of QE. I make comparisons. I think about the comparisons to the Fed and the Fed programs in the aftermath of the subprime crisis. And one of the things that was constructive about the Fed programs was Treasury indemnification of the Fed against loss in some of these programs. For the example, the TALF, there was a Treasury would cover losses that might fall to the Fed from their purchases of securities under this program. So we don't see the same thing happening in the ECB, for the ECB. And part of the reason is that you have political fragmentation in the euro area and disagreement among governments. You'd have to have an agreement between the ECB on the one hand and governments on the other to move this forward. But this is regrettable because if we could, then we could have a basis for a more robust QE program in Europe, I suspect. But so my question for you is: to what extent is the ECB hesitation for a robust QE program motivated by a concern for loss on the ECB balance sheet, or is it really all concern about maintaining discipline on the governments whose bonds would be purchased under the program?
Yeah, as I try to argue that I think it's both, and I think that the issue of maintaining discipline, it has been the focus of the discussion. And so that's why I try to, you know, to have, you know, to try to frame it in the way I hope I was sufficiently clear. I mean, I think that these issues of discipline and moral hazard is much stronger in the monetary union than outside the monetary union. Because of there is this because of the lack of budgetary responsibilities, and so you know the suspicions that the credit countries will eventually bail out everybody. When there was a discussion of Greece. That came out very clearly. There was this also in the OMT. There was this discussion of seniority. Okay, whether the ECB could maintain a seniority status, and I think this issue of seniority is still, you know, is being very much discussed. So I think they do worry, and the decentralization of risk, goes in the direction of coping with that problem.
Okay? But it seems bizarre to have a central bank that is willing to buy private assets and then to express concern about the credit risk of buying sovereign bonds.
And this this notion that somehow the worst case scenario is that the ECB doesn't get paid back on some Portuguese or Greek bonds, when the alternative is the whole thing falls apart and it seems...
Yeah,
it seems,
I agree. But, yeah. So it's a federation of countries.
Right. I mean, it goes to the question of the whole design of the thing in the first place. Just a little bit of clarification, Randy. So the Treasury didn't indemnify the Fed on QE. They refused to indemnify the Fed on Bear Stearns. After there was this pool of money in the TARP, some of that was provided a buffer to the Fed. And there was this talk, wasn't there, about turning the ESFS into a bank and
yes,
then do that?
That was
and
that rejected. Was,
that
yeah.
was rejected. So rejected. It was on the table and rejected. That on with the TARP money, yes, there was the first tranche loss would be the Fed. But the TALF was pretty small compared to $4 trillion of QE. Brenda, is the gentleman right in front of you?
You mentioned recent Italian labor...
Please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Kim Wallace at Renaissance Macro Research. You mentioned recent labor reforms in Italy. Pardon me. And in June of 2012, the European leaders agreed to the four building block strategies. The first two, fiscal and banking union, have gone moderately well. The third, internal markets reform, is next up, supposedly. Are you optimistic that the leaders will send a package to Parliament and Parliament will vote this year on reforms of capital, labor, and trade rules?
Yeah, I mean, I think they will go at the pace in which they go. Okay, so this has been on the air for a long time. They are late, but... I mean, if you hear them talking, in the parliament, so on the political side now, they're all in favor. So it's not clear why this is a delay. So I think we will get there, but the question is whether we will get there, fast enough. And I think what has been disappointing is the investment plan. Okay, because this is really what everybody. If you go to Europe now. Everybody says yes, but now we want to do growth, and then we have this investment plan and so on. And then, if you look at the investment plan, it's nothing. Okay, so that maybe they need another shock. I don't know what though, because we had France, Greece.
Putin. John Barry.
I'm John Barry, a freelance writer. I've just had the pleasure of being in Greece for the last couple of weeks. And lots of people are really unhappy there. Nobody had a fascinating conversation with a taxi cab driver who says taxes on his Mercedes taxi gone from about 600 euros a year to about 6,000. I can't verify those numbers, but it's... He's feeling really put upon.
Did he say he was paying it or not?
He was in his cab for about 20 minutes, and the sort of minimum flat rate was only 5 euros. Really cheap taxi fares. But my question is, if the opposition party does win, and... says to the Troika, look, we are achieving a primary surplus, not the 3% that we that had been the target, but 1.5 to 2. And that's really more than we can even stand. So we've got to have some kind of debt restructuring, or else we'll just walk away. I have no idea how that would... I'm sorry?
I didn't hear what you said. Debt restructuring, or else?
Or else we will walk away. In other words, we will simply stop paying on the debt. With the kind of unemployment they've got, I mean, it's 50% among youth and 25% overall. The sense I got from talking to people was that they thought it can't really be much worse. So what happens if you come to that kind of impasse? Will somebody finally say, look, that really is more than we can ask a country to live with?
Well, as I said, I think it's a I don't think that they will unilaterally say we want to restructure the debt, or we go out, or we go out. I don't think they will do that, because they know that this is dangerous. They don't want to get out of the euro, so they have said that. 75% of the Greek citizens don't want to get out of the euro, so they will, you know, they will have to be respectful of, the, you know, of the voters. And actually, Syriza has said very clearly that he does not want to get out of the euro, but that he thinks that debt redemption is the right thing to go, or that or some kind of renegotiation. So I think that there will be renegotiation, but probably not in the terms he wants, okay? So that they will reschedule, and there is the issue of the IMF. I remember that is all official debt in Greece. I mean, 85%, 90% is official. So I think the IMF is out of the question, okay? Because I think that, you know, that's, I mean, I can't imagine even what the American would say in that case, right? I don't think they will participate to the recapitalization of the IMF in that case. So it's all about the ECB, eh? So as usual. And, I think there will be a negotiation. I think that's what people, you know, think. That's what, you know, people close to the issue think, that there will be some negotiation. But at terms which are much harder than what Syriza has been sold to his voters.
A gentleman in the front here.
I am Alessandro Leipold of the Lisbon Council, which, despite its name, is actually a think tank in Brussels, and I live in Washington, so it's all a bit complicated. But as an Italian, living in Washington, in fact, and observing Europe from this side of the Atlantic, you know, through all these years of the euro crisis, I've spent my time arguing with American skeptics that they always underestimated or overestimated the risk of a breakup of the euro and the emu, because basically they underestimated the political will to keep it together. And that's perfectly true. It didn't make all that much economic sense. It's not an optimal currency area or the other things we know, but that there was this political will that kept it together all these years. I'm worried that argument is now wearing thin, that politics, which was the glue of EMU up till now, risks becoming its centrifugal force. And I don't know whether you agree with that. I think for that to continue to be the case, I think we'd need a sort of quantum leap in the political resolve, a QE that was not, you know, that was agreed in a not divisive way and not excessively compromised in the way you illustrated, and political will on other fronts. And I just don't see that happening. So perhaps, you know, muddling through can work forever. I'm not sure, but I'm growing increasingly skeptical.
But do you see a lessening of the political will to hold the euro together? You didn't sound like it.
Well, I think that the political will is still there, but I also agree that is, you know, that the people are getting tired. Okay, so it's thinning. And I think how the Greek compromise will be reached will be instructive, because the Greek debt is all official, and in particular, I mean, you know, because it's through the ESM, ECB, etc. So if we go for restructuring Greece, it means that the Italians also will be penalized, the Spanish will be penalized, not only the Germans. So that, you know, in that sense, I think is really interesting. It will be really interesting to see what is the extent of, you know, tolerance, you know, because also other peripheral countries will be involved in this credit event. So, you know, it's a dangerous situation in that respect, and will be a test of, you know, what is our political will to be together. But for sure, the treaty is broken, because everybody is in breach of the treaty now. So it will have to be changed. You know, that's the next step, okay? because no countries respect the deficit, except for maybe Italy, but even now Italy is in breach. So the more you respect it, the worse your economy is, by the way. So anyway, so no country respect the deficit. The Germans don't respect the macroeconomic procedure, that adjustment procedure that would recommend them to expand fiscally. Instead, they have this balanced budget thing. So everybody is in breach of some rules. So, you know, you cannot have a treaty that nobody cares, you know, that nobody respect, because that's worse than not having any treaty. So that some changes will have to.
I think we have to end it there. Three things. One, if you look to your feet, if there's a paper or a paper cup there or a plate, there's a garbage can in the back, and we'd appreciate that. Secondly, if you haven't had enough economics this morning, at 10:30 we're going to discuss the domestic and defense spending caps in the U.S. in the room next door. And thirdly, please join me in thanking Lucrecia Wright for an excellent presentation.